From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Watergate has become synonymous with abuse of power in the White House. 40 years ago, the scandal forced Richard Nixon to resign, the only U.S. president to do so. As the nation remembers on this anniversary, Nixon's White House counsel at the time, John Dean, has released a comprehensive review of the episode called The Nixon Defense. He's gone through 1,000 hours of surreptitiously recorded tape detailing blow by blow how Nixon dug himself into a matchless hole in history. Dean was deeply involved, but he became a key witness for the prosecution, and now he's one of Watergate's foremost historians. All that's coming up on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. In the wee hours of June 17, 1972, 5 burglars were caught trying to bug the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee. It wasn't long before they were linked to the Republican Committee to reelect the president. While Richard Nixon may not have been involved in planning the caper, he was heavily involved in trying to cover it up. His former counsel, John Dean, has written an exhaustive review of what happened called The Nixon Defense, and he joins us now in studio to talk about it. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Rachel.
Why do we need another book about Watergate? You yourself have already written 2.
When I wrote my first books, I had, you know, my own personal knowledge. The book I've done now is only possible because we have ability to reach all the information, the key information being what was Nixon's role, and the question that was asked me in the subtitle of my book, what did he know and when did he know it? That's been the mystery. That's been the unanswered question. And until recently, it was not possible to do that. My publishers asked if I had any lingering questions, and my question was, how could anybody as intelligent as Nixon, as politically savvy as he was, let his presidency implode on a bungled burglary? And that's what this book sets out to answer day by day, to see how he did this, you know, see what happened, why it came down the way it did, and to answer all the unanswered questions, which this book does.
What do you think the answer is to that question? Why? Why did he let his presidency founder on this stupid quest?
It's not a good question to soundbite answer. I had to transcribe 1,000 conversations. I had to find them first, assemble them, and then transcribe them to follow his behavior. And it's erratic. You see different behavior at different times, responding to different situations. And the short answer, I suppose, is it's a combination of his character. And the big surprise to me is some of the shoddiest decision-making I've ever seen at that high a level of decision-making. And that all was not apparent until I got in and understood, you know, how he sorted this out and what facts he had when. He was not given all the information that was available that he should have had early. He's more passive early than he is later when he becomes very active and very involved. But it's a story. It's much more human than I might have fully anticipated. There's a lot of drama in it. And what I did is not prepare a book of transcripts, but rather use the transcripts to form the narrative and from which I draw dialogue. So it has a novelistic storytelling part of it.
There were already about 450 taped conversations that had been transcribed by other people. You and a team of diligent transcribers added more than 600 more of those.
Well, the 400 that existed, we redid all those.
You did those as well.
So it was 1,000 conversations.
It's a monumental task, and we want to give listeners a sense of what kind of task it was. We've got an excerpt here from what is often referred to as the cancer on the presidency conversation.
This is probably my voice, and I happened to go in and sit over a microphone every time I was in the Oval Office. My voice is somehow in a range that those little microphones
always
picked up.
Did you know at the time you were being recorded?
No, no idea.
Wow. Okay. Let's listen to just a little bit of this conversation from March 21st, 1973.
You need the money. I mean, you can get the money.
Well, I think this is where
my man is. You can get the $1 million.
Well, we're just going to play that much because, as everyone can hear, wow, that's not easy listening.
That's not easy listening. But what happened at that point in the conversation, Nixon is actually sitting up in his chair. Normally, I'd go in there. He'd have his feet up on the desk. The microphone that picked up his voice on his side of the desk was down by his left-hand side bottom drawer. And so with his legs up, he'd often be talking through his legs and that would muffle the sound even more. Here, I can tell the position of various people around the desk just because of their voice and its relationship to the microphone. So here, that is very good. That also happens to be a very explosive thing he said. I had raised the fact – I was in there trying to convince him to end the cover-up being the cancer. And I was going one by one by one item. And at this point, when he says that it'd be no problem to raise $1 million, what had happened is I had said, you know, these guys are demanding money. We don't know how to do this. It's illegal. It's obstruction of justice. And then I came back again, you know, who knows how much they're going to want. And I thought I pulled out of thin air what I thought was a pretty hefty number. I'd never thought about how much they could demand. But when he asked me the question, how much they could wanted. And I said, well, you know, it could be $1 million over the next 2 years. That would be, what, $5.5 million maybe in today's dollars. And to my surprise, there's a pause. And then he comes back and says, well, that's no problem. I know where we can get that. That conversation will later haunt him because he hasn't forgotten. And months later, about April 15th, when he is trying to start distancing himself from his own activities. Excuse me. That comes up in a conversation with me, and he says, of course, you knew when I said it would be no problem to get $1 million, I was just joking. And I said, well, if Mr. President, it didn't sound like that to me, but it's what you say. I hear you.
I didn't believe him,
but I heard him.
Depressing reading, you know, listening or reading rather conversation after conversation and realizing that when there were attempts such as yours in that particular instance to sort of bring some sanity, some maturity into the conversation, they were batted aside by Nixon and by others.
Well, you know, back to your first question, why even do this book? What we study our presidents. We look at the way they handle themselves in office. And we've really not looked very close. We look at Nixon's policies, but we don't look at what the biggest decisions he made that destroyed his president. And that's why I had this unique, never again will we have a president who self-records himself like this secretly. And so it's a very unique source. And it was for that reason, it was worth it to me to go through and transcribe, or with my grad students, transcribe the 1,000 conversations, because I didn't publish in fact, some of my critics have said, well, you should have published the transcripts. Well, that's 4 million words. I have 21 3-inch notebooks filled solidly. It's about 8,500 pages, wide margins, single spaced. You know, this will be a multi-volume set. What I'll do eventually is put it out electronically. But in my own process, the way I handle it is I needed to – I'm very digital. I do – you know, I work on – with multiple computers. I do both Apple and Mac and PC, and I have all these things set up. But for some reason, the only way I could really do these transcripts – was to print them out and then listen to them. And I could tell from whether the transcriber had trouble or not just by the quality of the transcript. And when they had trouble and it seemed something important, I would listen to that myself and make notes on the transcript. So this 8,500-page collection is filled with my notes. So before I can publish it, I have to go back through. That's probably another 6-7 months of work. And this was 4 years to get this book published. Not my publisher was waiting for it. I had a publisher waiting for it. It wasn't, but just the mechanics of doing it. We had had I known, I might not have even taken it on.
So let me ask you, I mean, as you say, like, this is the last president who's going to allow himself to be recorded thinking openly about all kinds of things, including breaking the law. But that's not to say that presidents who followed Nixon weren't having those conversations off mic. What do you think we see about Nixon that is unique? What is not unique about him?
Well, I think the office itself, that's why we study it, because it's the most powerful office in the world, if you will. And I think there's a lot of commonality between presidents. They tend to draw on the precedents of one another. Nixon always used the rationalization, and there's some conversations in the book where he's doing it with me, that he's not doing anything other presidents hadn't done. There is a difference when I actually looked at it historically. Yeah, it's true that many of the things that were illicit and actually kind of seamy had been done by other presidents, no question. But the difference being, Nixon made it into something of a standard operating procedure where it had been the exception to the rule with prior presidents. But I think we can learn how the office works. There are times, as the story goes on, you see Nixon becoming so involved and obsessive about Watergate, he's paying attention to nothing else. And what is striking is the presidency actually works pretty well without a president.
Grim assessment. I'm curious. You did testify against the Nixon administration, but you also went to prison for your part on the cover-up. Why should the American public trust your read of this history?
Well, first they can check it themselves. If you're saying my qualification is that I testified against them, my testimony was upheld and corroborated by the tapes. Why would I, distort it now? I technically didn't go to prison. I was in the witness protection program for a year and a half because the death threats were so serious. So I spend 120 days of that period of the year and a half in the witness protection program back in Washington during the trial, and they literally take me to the Watergate prosecutor's office every day. I sleep in a safe house at night. I can't say I was in prison. I mean, I don't dispute it that I was incarcerated, but it would be I'm eating in restaurants and what have you. It's just not exactly the prison experience. So I'm doing this book as much out of my own curiosity to get the answers. I read a review of the book on Sunday, and a fellow from Stanford wrote the review for the New York Times, and he said, well, this book could be called The Dean Defense, as if I knew that going in. I didn't know it was on all these other tapes, but I do come out well. There's no question. But that wasn't the design going in. It was just really to understand what had happened, as I say, how Nixon could let this thing destroy his presidency.
And take a number of men down with him.
He took some 30 people got on the wrong side of the law, including 20 lawyers.
You know, a few years ago, I'm thinking of the book Eagle Bud Krogh wrote called Integrity. And
yes.
he was set up at a very young age to handle the group that was charged with investigating leaks. So they were known as the Plumbers. And as the title suggests, there comes a time when a person's internal moral compass has to trump the value of political or personal loyalty. At least that's how he read his involvement with this chapter in American history.
Well, Bud says some very kind things about me in his book as far as veracity. And excuse me. When I had gotten wind of an earlier burglary that Nixon – we have tapes of Nixon authorizing a break-in into the think tank in Washington called the Brookings Institute. And when I heard of it, I didn't know it had come from the president. But I jumped on the next plane from Washington to California, San Clemente, where the president and the senior staff were, to say this was just the craziest thing I'd ever heard and to put a stop to it. Bud said that was a very bold act. you know, I just looked upon it as something that, you know, that we all know is right and wrong. And some of these things were just crazy. Most of us that got on the wrong side of the law in Watergate didn't go across intentionally. We slipped across and found ourselves on the wrong side. These are not bright-line crimes. Conspiracy to obstruct justice doesn't present a blinking light like, say, committing perjury. That's a very clear crime, and most everybody knows that crime. But to get into a conspiracy to obstruct justice is pretty fuzzy stuff at times.
He talks a lot in his book about being a young man, having personal connections with people in the administration, wanting to please, feeling passionately involved in the cause of this presidency. Do you look back on it and think, I mean, you did speak out internally at various points. Do you think, I wish I'd spoken out more strongly or more quickly?
Well, you know, I've thought about that, and I'm not sure it would have made any difference with this president. What happened, for example, when I ended the Brookings Institute burglary, they cut me out. Bud Krogh came to me later and said, John, he said, I'm setting up an operation that under normal circumstances probably would be in your shop, and I'm not even allowed to talk to you about it. And he and I were friends then. We're still friends to this day. And that was because I had, squashed the plan to break in the Brookings. So they just thought that don't tell him about these things because they didn't fire me for it, but,
they cut you out of the conversation.
You got it. And that's the way things operated there.
Turning now to the legacy of Watergate on American politics and culture, what do you think its legacy is? We're 40 years out now.
It has remained. We obviously are talking about it now because we just have hit that 40-year anniversary of Nixon's resignation over the last weekend on the 9th, on Saturday. It has remained very real in Washington for those who still understand it. Its stigma still. It's a watermark of what is clearly unacceptable behavior. It did result in the use of the tool of impeachment to deal with wrongdoing at the highest level. Republicans never seemed to get over the fact that it was used against a Republican president. And I can't tell you, I worked for MSNBC during the Clinton impeachment, and I spent more time back in Washington during that, almost 4 months, collectively, but long stretches, and lots of time in the green room when I wasn't on camera with one of the anchors. I was an anchor, what I call an anchor buddy, which is somebody that when there's nobody in the field for the anchor to talk to, can't think of anything to say. He turns to his anchor buddy and says, "What do you think?" And you're supposed to say something that'll fill in the airtime. But anyway. As a result, I talked to anybody and everybody who was important to that impeachment proceeding. They had no idea politically where I was because I really didn't have any position at all on it. I was just sort of there as an observer and talking about mechanics of it and what have you and how this works, that works, and so on. And the Republicans with whom I spoke repeatedly said to me, "We're doing this to get even." In essence, they did it to Nixon. We're going to do it to Clinton. And that's what we're seeing again with Obama. And that's one of the legacies of Watergate. This talk in Republican circles of impeaching Obama is pure nonsense. I mean, I actually told my editor we should send a copy of this book to every Republican member of the House so they understand what is impeachable behavior. Because now it's just being used as a tool to besmirch a politician's record by impeaching him in the House, and then
it just becomes a tool of party politics.
Exactly, and it's really and using that is an abuse of the process itself.
It seems to me that there are other parallels as well that cross party lines, if you will. I mean, when Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times in 1971, the Nixon administration saw it, you know, not just as a national security issue or perhaps national security conflated with personal and political self-interest there, but it also seems like with the Snowden revelations that there's a way in which the Obama administration responds in the same way. It's called national security, but it's kind of conflated with self-protection.
I know Dan Ellsberg, and he and I have remained friends all these years. And I am surprised, frankly, at the Obama administration's approach on this. It's like the people from the Bush administration just never left. Attorney General Ashcroft under Bush had cobbled together statutes that were never designed to deal with government secrecy into something of an Official Secrets Act, which the UK has and which makes it a criminal offense to leak information. We don't have that. We've never had that in our system. Bill Clinton almost signed but then vetoed an Official Secrets Act. The key statute that's being used is a 1917 Espionage Act, where another part of that original act dealt with leaks and leaking official information. It was expressly rejected by the U.S. Senate. So it's tortured readings, if you will, and distorted readings of this 1917 act that's being used to go after people that are being prosecuted. And it's not Snowden. There have been more prosecutions under that law by the Obama administration than any prior administration. Richard Nixon's got to be smiling somewhere. This is the way he would deal with it.
So let's imagine President Obama calls you up on the phone and says, "John Dean, what do you think I should do about Snowden?"
Well, look at Dan Ellsberg also stood up and took responsibility for his action, didn't hide from it, and said, "Yes, I did it, and I did it for this reason, that reason." My deepest problem with Snowden is he, like many, signed an agreement that he would not leak information and that if he did, he would be susceptible to criminal action. That's a different situation than Dan Ellsberg said, "I'm responsible and let's test the law." That's what Snowden should be doing, is testing the law. Some of these other people who've been prosecuted have not really very effectively tested the law. And it's still uncertain whether we have this kind of statute or not, like the UK.
Do you think, looking back on it and in this context, that Nixon's famously intense paranoia maybe wasn't so specific to him?
Well, I'd be the first, and anybody who's worked in the White House would tell you, no president can govern in a fishbowl. You just can't do it. We have enemies. We have people who want to destroy our country and our way of life.
And as president, you have access to a lot of information about that.
You do. And you become sensitive when you are trying to make a decision and you're reading your options on the front page of the New York Times. This limits your options. This affects your ability to govern. So it's not that I'm against reasonable classification, but we also overclassify. We classify things and keep them hidden too long. So if we had a president that wanted transparency, fine. But using secrecy as a tool, not so good.
We're talking with John Dean, former counsel to the Nixon White House and author of the just-released Nixon Defense, one of three books Dean has written about those events 40 years ago. Got a question for him? Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking with John Dean, former counsel to the Nixon White House and author of The Nixon Defense. John Dean will be appearing tonight at 7 at Book Passage in Corte Madera and tomorrow at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, also at 7 p.m. Well, we've already got lots of people on the phone eager to ask you questions, including Joan of Oakland.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, and it's nice to hear you. Mr. Dean, and my question is, I don't understand why President Nixon did not turn the tape recorder off when he was incriminating himself. Why, when he was discussing sensitive information, did he not turn it off?
Be happy to explain that. When the system was installed, those who installed it thought the president, it's kind of awkward. and would not be the easily, if he was across the room or something, able to get over to his desk and hit a switch to turn it on or off, or that he might be very conspicuous in doing it if it was in front of him even. He's a man who had great difficulty, say, with the medicine bottles where you had to press down the top and turn the top. I would see him with those in his mouth trying to get the top off. So he just wasn't a mechanical kind of person. Wow. The staff knew that. So let me tell you what they did is they put in a voice-activated system. And it's clear he forgets he's being recorded. There's time he also, and I put some of these in the book, where he's in the middle of a conversation talking to Haldeman saying, I know you were involved in the cover-up. I know Ehrlichman was involved in the cover-up. I was involved in the cover-up. And then a beat later he says, no, I wasn't involved in the cover-up. Like he remembers that he's just admitted something that was very detrimental to himself. But most times he forgets he's recording. And he has the recording equipment on his telephone, and he has it in his in the Oval Office, in his EOB office, as well as his study at Camp David. So almost every place he was making decisions, you have recordings of those. And it's only when he's off in Air Force One or Florida or out here in California that the record is not complete. He often, in writing the book, I was able to fill that in from his diary and other notes he often made. But he's left a remarkable record of Watergate.
Is that what he wanted to get out of those recordings?
The system was put in because initially in the White House had I'm pausing because I'm thinking how he was instructed or suggested by Lyndon Johnson during the transition to record because Johnson had a system with a switch. And he rejected that. He didn't want that. And he also told Haldeman on two occasions, I report in the book, that to take the system out. He's uncomfortable with it. Haldeman, because he gets consumed by Watergate, doesn't do it. But anyway, the system is there because they had a reporting system where aides would come in with, particularly when a stranger was in with the president. He wanted a historical record of what happened in that meeting. And he also, particularly if he made a decision and told that person not from the staff about his decision, he wanted somebody to make an independent third-party record of it. Well, the system broke down, and the memos got way behind. So Haldeman came in January of 1971 and said, Our system is not working. I think we ought to do what Lyndon Johnson suggested and put a taping system in. And that's when they put the voice-activated system in, and it starts in February of 71, and the system is withdrawn, and the plug is pulled, if you will, on July 16th of 73, when Alex Butterfield revealed, actually in responding to my thought that I had been recorded, which I suspected because of Nixon's bizarre behavior in one conversation, that indeed I was recorded, as was everybody else who'd been in there.
Do you have any sense of whether that still goes on today?
It does to a very limited degree. I was interviewed by Bob Woodward, who has covered the presidency, and he, when he went in to interview Obama, he had two little tape recorders that he put on the desk for redundancy, just in case one went out, he'd have a second one. And Obama looked at his press aide and then looked at Woodward and said, "Can you believe Nixon recorded everything in here? We're never going to do that." But what they do record is head of state conversations. Those are still being recorded. Heads of state on both sides understand that. It's done for not necessarily historical purposes as much as to make sure there's no misunderstanding that can happen in translation and things of that nature. So that still goes on. And they have been used. So that's available.
Thank you so much, Joan. Turning now to Robert in Jenner.
Yes, Mr. Dean, I thank you for your candid honesty, and I would like to ask you a multi-question in reference to your statement that presidents rely on the precedent of what prior presidents did. And in a short interview in Time magazine, you make the reference to the Reagan presidency and the Iran-Contra affair as much more serious. And I myself have an acute perception that Ronald Reagan committed an act of treason against a standing president who was Jimmy Carter. And why do so many Americans have considered Ronald Reagan a hero? Iran was our enemy, and why was he allowed to commit such a criminal act?
Well, I'm not your best expert on Iran-Contra. I followed it, and I the person I mentioned that had when I was talking with someone in Washington that thought Iran-Contra was more serious than Watergate happened to be Ben Bradley, who was the editor of the Washington Post during Watergate and a well-recognized journalistic editor and a very able guy. He thought that Iran-Contra, the implications of it were so much more serious on multi levels than just a bungled burglary at the DNC and then a botched cover up. That they were not even in a similar league. But the big difference there again is how it was handled. The Reagan people, maybe they learned from Watergate. Maybe, hopefully, people, they don't learn better cover-ups, but they learn to be more cautious in the underlying conduct. But the Reagan people seem to have handled the overall problem better. And, of course, as you know, everybody who did get prosecuted in that, if their case wasn't overturned on a technicality, George Bush won, pardoned them, so gave them a pass. Nixon might have – there are conversations I hadn't been aware of until I did this book that Nixon, in essence, told many people that he would pardon everybody involved in Watergate if he got away with it. He didn't get away with it, so he didn't pass out any pardons.
I wonder, though, whether in a sense, despite or perhaps because of the shock – of Watergate on the American population, whether it opened a new door and made it possible for people to simply accept extra-legal behavior on the part of presidencies?
Well, that's extra-legal behavior by presidents is not new. We go back to the Civil War and Lincoln and the extraordinary actions he took to preserve the Union. Nixon, who famously said to David Frost, when the president does it, that means it's not illegal, even if it is illegal. He's drawing on Lincoln. He's drawing on FDR. He's drawing on precedents that come down right to today where a president sets his own policy for things like drones or we just breach our treaties, which are the law of the land, and we torture people when that is not our law, and no one does anything. Yes, there are people who complain, and there's public outcry, but I haven't seen anybody prosecuted for torture, which is a pretty serious war crime.
Martin writes, Snowden was right to run from Bradley Manning-style torture and the unjust star chamber the government is running that won't let him use a whistleblower defense.
Well, on the Snowden situation— as I understand it, he didn't go through the whistleblower procedures that would make him eligible for the defense. I'm not an expert in that area of the law at all. And his actions have certainly been revelatory as to what NSA was doing, and it's pretty horrifying. I actually testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee when they were considering some amendments to the Patriot Act. I think that's a horrible law. And
you could argue the ball game has changed.
The ball game has changed. But, this is – I can find no lineage to Watergate in this other than the fact, if anything, of public tolerance of it, that a majority of the members of the House and Senate – well, in the aftermath of 9/11 – everyone went so far overboard that what they did in creating the Patriot Act was just went in their drawer at the Justice Department. Everything they couldn't have gotten in earlier years, they put in one statute. And these were things they had tried to get earlier. And they lean so far in favor of law enforcement that it's absurd. And they have never gone back and really cleaned that law up.
We're talking with John Dean. What questions do you have for him about the Nixon defense and – pretty much all the presidencies that followed after Nixon. Call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I do want to make one correction. We said earlier that John Dean will be at the Commonwealth Club tomorrow in San Francisco. He will, but not at 7 p.m., at 6 p.m. Bill writes, Mr. Dean, how does the policy or concept of plausible deniability play into the actions of former President Nixon regarding his subsequent public actions to remediate the situation and defend his most important administrative executives, such as yourself?
One of the interesting things you see in the book, as I tried to understand day by day how it unfolded for Nixon, is that he engages in something called willful denial or willful ignorance. Very early, he instructs Haldeman to tell both Colson and Ehrlichman, who have access to him, not to talk about Watergate. He does not want to be told about it. But then his own curiosity gets the better of him, and he starts asking questions. And when he does it of Ehrlichman, for example, Ehrlichman doesn't tell him what he needs to know, nor does Haldeman. So the plausible deniability was actually very much in Nixon's mind by the sort of one of the side effects is just don't give me the information so I can not have any knowledge to be guilty of. But then he starts asking the questions, but his aides, to my surprise, don't give it to him. And I think he needed to have that information early.
You know, I'm thinking here about the famous 18 and a half minutes, the smoking gun from 1972. It was such a big deal in the 1970s, certainly because people thought that there was critical information there. But now looking back on it after 1,000 recordings, do you think that it was that big a deal?
Not at all. You mix two Watergate-related metaphors, the smoking gun and the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. The smoking gun was the tape or the tapes, a series of conversations that occurred on June 23rd of 1972 that resulted in Nixon having to leave office. This was the sure evidence that he had obstructed justice. The gap is another issue. This comes up after he has fired the special prosecutor and he has agreed to start turning over tapes. And when he does so, one technical problem after another, he says, well, this conversation wasn't recorded. He's asked for three conversations on June 20th of 1972, 3 days after the arrests at the Watergate. And he says that the one with the conversation with John Mitchell was not recorded because it happened in the residence where there's no recording equipment. But he said, the other ones I'll have. And then a few days later or weeks later, he comes into court after having more of these kinds of problems, which is building the issue up. And after the firing of the special prosecutor, the story is just very sensitive. Anything amiss becomes big news. So then this giant story comes back. His lawyer goes into court and says that there's 18 and a half minute gap in the June 20th tape in the morning. We don't know what happened to it. It's got this high, shrill noise. Judge John Sirica opened a hearing right there and brought in experts, and they found out soon that it had been intentionally erased. I did an appendix on just on this issue because it has fascinated the press. I think it's a non-issue. It has absolutely zero historical significance.
How do you know?
Well, because I know everything this man said about Watergate, and I know exactly why he would have wanted to erase that tape. I know who had access and could have erased it. And rather than giving a longer answer, I'll let readers find that for themselves in Appendix C.
Oh, you're teasing us now.
Actually, I was reading the e-book version I hadn't seen until this weekend, and I was reading it last night, and I just decided to read Appendix C. And the way I wrote the book, the reader really needs to read the entire book before they get to the appendix, rather than jump into Appendix C to get fully understand. And what he's erasing is the fact that he knows there's been a cover-up. He knew it and participated in it long before I warned him on March 21st about a cover-up. And that's his last defense. And so he's protecting this bogus defense that he had no knowledge of a cover-up. Because he clearly, on the 20th, he's talking about a cover-up. In the other conversations, he's talking about it on the 21st, the 22nd, the 23rd. There's plenty of talk. In any one of those, had they subpoenaed them.
There's so many smoking guns.
There's so many smoking guns, right.
It was a firing squad if they had been listening to all of them.
Exactly.
Winston writes, Mr. Dean, what do you think of Patrick Buchanan's op-ed piece last week entitled Liberal Elites Toppled Nixon, in which he pays obligatory lip service to the obvious facts of the case, but still manages to imply that it was not Nixon's actions that led to lack of congressional support for Nixon and his subsequent resignation, but a raving left-wing conspiracy which was only acting on partisan political grounds? Is Buchanan's piece in and of itself the legacy from Watergate?
I saw Pat when we both did the
Stephen Colbert's
report, and I chat. I've talked to him over the years, and Pat is a partisan and an advocate, and he's making a case that will not hold up in the broader examination of history. In fact, there were conservative groups that organized to remove Nixon. A lot of conservatives who now don't want to even look at these facts or don't want to look at them realistically, that's where the criticism has been coming from my book, for the Wall Street Journal review of it, for example, was by one of the real Nixon toadies who just made all kinds of – it's like he didn't read the book and just started making his observations. But they don't like the facts, and Pat is wrong on the facts. It was not driven by a group of liberals. Nixon himself provoked his own impeachment by his conduct. And if you follow it day by day, as the tapes make it now possible to reconstruct, you can see how he got himself in the mess he did. And Pat hasn't read all this material and may never, but I suspect he'll take a look at it and have a better understanding. And while he won't retract his op-ed piece, he might be more cautious if people understand that he's way off base. My book, I'm grinding the axe for no one, but rather just trying to understand what's on the tapes. In fact, I stay out of the commentary business. I let the story unfold so it speaks for itself, and let that record show exactly what happened. And it does.
You know, it's interesting reading so much of Nixon talking about Watergate, and, you know, especially in the beginning where he's starting to craft plausible stories to tell the press and to tell Congress about what happened and who was at fault, and, you know, describing basically these overzealous political operatives who were, you know, had read too many spy novels. But then you think, you know, there are so many cases of so many situations where Nixon operatives were trying to bug different places. Nixon is describing his own people.
Well, he is. I find no evidence that Nixon had advanced knowledge of the Watergate break-in. That does not explain the situation, though. He creates, one, an atmosphere in which he would have every reason to believe his aides would think he would be delighted for them to accomplish such an undertaking. He has ordered a prior break-in into the Brookings Institute with the same people who end up breaking into the Watergate. Those same people did a break-in into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office.
That's right.
Were they reprimanded for it? No, they were given better jobs.
But these are cockamamie ideas. I mean, you think, okay, Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office? What could they possibly hope to gain? Watergate, Nixon, it looked like a clear path to re-election. What were they thinking?
Or not thinking. I didn't tell you the answer I found in brief to my reason for my inquiry in doing this book is, how could somebody so savvy mess things up? The bottom line, he's not so savvy. That's what it really comes down to. And you see this. You understand that he lets his own thoughts about the exercise of power that he can just power through these things and he can write facts and rewrite history the way he wants it, doesn't work. And he's bright enough to know what he's doing, but he is just not as savvy as one might have thought he would be in the position he was in.
Let's turn now to Jill.
Hi, I've really enjoyed listening to you today, and I have a quick question. I didn't take lightly when you said about Nixon being the last president to ever secretly record himself, and I'm just very concerned going forward with the idea that both Democratic, you know, a Democratic president would shut down the open discussion of the amount of government surveillance that goes on every day. And I'm just very concerned going forward if it really makes any difference with the kind of candidates who are being elected with this increasing, brushing aside of civil rights and freedom of the press. So I'll take your answer, but thank you so much.
Yeah, my point was that Nixon taped himself with a voice-activated system he had no control of. No president is ever going to tape himself again in such a fashion where he has no control over what he's recording and what he's not. Few people would do that. That's the point I'm making, not that there isn't surveillance going on. In fact, while Nixon was out busy wiretapping newsmen and his national security staff, by today's standard of what NSA is doing, I mean, it wasn't even chicken feed. It's just crumbs of chicken feed for his activities. So the surveillance state we're in today in the digital era we're in is a whole different thing, and that is not resolved by my book or even really addressed by my book. I'm really trying to explain a historical event that is tossed around. The label is used, and I don't think it's well understood. When I testified before Congress, for example, Lindsey Graham was making all these references about Watergate and saying Nixon did this and Nixon did that. Well, he was just dead wrong on most of the stuff he was saying. He had no conception of what he was really talking about. So to prevent that from happening, because this is a part of our history, we seem to be a country that likes to ignore our history so we can repeat it. Well, that maybe by getting it out there accurately, I can prevent that.
Thank you so much for your question, Jill. Bruce in Danville.
Hi. I grew up in Iran during the 70s and Nixon's presidency, and if there's any saving grace, I think it's his foreign policy successes. I was wondering what it was like, given the drastic difference between U.S.-Iran relations back then and today, what it was like, if you were that fly on that wall, to be in the White House during a completely different U.S.-Iran relations era, and what President Nixon thought of, Iran at that time.
Well, the national security was not something the White House counsel got in. That wasn't part of the business of my office. Occasionally, there was some areas we got into, but not often. I personally happened to visit Tehran during the Nixon presidency. I can tell you some striking feelings I had about the caution I was told to take about leaving the hotel. When I met with the ambassador, for example, we went up to the top floor and we went into a tent so we could have a conversation in this big bubble so that couldn't be recorded by outsiders. I happened to have had a freshman in college roommate from Iran who I was trying to track down, and because I'd lost track of him, and we didn't find him. As life always has its ironies, many decades later, I'm doing a book tour in Santa Monica and find he's the city manager of Santa Monica, which is a stone's throw from where I live, and we've renewed our friendship.
Thank you so much for that question. As a result of reading through all these transcripts, one of the characters you've gotten to watch closely in retrospective is Henry Kissinger, Nixon's national security advisor. Did you gain any new insights from that?
Henry is somebody that Nixon uses as a sounding board from time to time, and that's why he's in this book. He's not really involved in Watergate other than the president is trying to assure Henry that everything is all right and this isn't going to fall apart. And he will test Henry about whether – he talks about resignation very early about the – he knows he's done things that he might – well be considering resignation for. And Kissinger keeps telling him, of course, that would be terrible, that he's important to the peace of the world and that no one else can handle that. So that drifts in and out. But I knew Henry, you know, well enough to know that and there was nothing on these tapes that show anything particularly different about Henry. He's something of a sycophant with the president and one of the masters of it, I might add, too. And that becomes apparent to the reader.
Yeah. So you don't necessarily walk away with a new assessment of him.
No, you don't.
We've been talking with John Dean, former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon, author of a number of books involving the Nixon administration, most recently, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John Dean will be appearing tonight at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera and tomorrow at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6 p.m. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Rachel Miro, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.